Welcome to Breakfast Conversations, the podcast where we sit down one-to-one with amazing educators from around the world and hear their stories and get a cup of coffee or tea. This is part two of my conversation with Joe Tung from Vancouver in Canada, and he is a coffee drinker. In the first part of this conversation, we heard about his great work at the University in Vancouver, where he teaches aspiring teachers and work a lot with inquiry-based methods. We also talked about how important it is to create an inclusive learning environment. So if you want to hear that part of the conversation, please now consider to pause this episode and jump back and listen to the previous one. But last time we also talked about how Joe has experienced both racism and how he works with anti-racism today. And Joe is also a part of the LGBT community and a big advocate for more inclusive classrooms. And I think it's so important that we as teachers are aware of creating a safe environment for all our learners and really embrace that diversity. Only if our learners feel safe, they are able to learn. So I think that's really a foundation for creating a good learning environment, that we are tolerant. In this part of our conversation, we go much deeper into both Joe's own experiences, but also he gives us some really good advice on how we as teachers can do a better job in embracing the diversity that we find in our classrooms. Last time we left the conversation at a point where we were talking about how important it is that we as teachers take care of ourselves, that self-care is necessary for being a good teacher that has the ability to also take care of the learners that we are working with. Now we are jumping back into the conversation at a point where Joe shares with us how it has been to be a part of two marginalized groups in the society and how that has impacted the work that he does today. So please enjoy the rest of the conversation I had with Joe Tung, and please also consider to follow Joe on Twitter and Instagram and on YouTube, where he soon is going to also share his projects and a lot of great videos about the vocabulary around the LGBT community. So that will be some really great learning resources for all of us and also our learners. So please follow Joe on Twitter, then I'm sure that he will keep you posted there. But now enjoy my conversation with Joe Tung.
Like, it's a community, right? At the very end of the day, and the LGBTQ community is very much small. Like it is a marginalized group. It's a minority group. So is the Chinese population in Canada, yeah. Right? And it, like, very much is a community and a marginalized community and a minority. And when certain things come up in the news, on Twitter, about, you know, certain hate crimes or even certain pamphlets that are being distributed at schools or in, you know, certain protests that are happening at school districts, or certain, you know, like rainbow sidewalks are a big thing. A lot of districts are putting money into that. Some of it I see is genuine, some of it's optics. Mm. But like putting in, you know, certain rainbow crosswalks and then having them defaced or having, you know, graffiti and things like that. Yes, it's not affecting me personally, but at the same time, like, it's my community, right? And it's probably what the hate groups want, but it is a signal to the community that they're not wanted. Mm. And it still affects us, right? And same thing in Vancouver with and it's like Vancouver and its surrounding areas, there's a lot of racist posts, and, you know, and nowadays you can take a video really quickly, you know, and like certain, you know, people who share videos of racist rants, usually a lot of the times against Chinese people, especially in where I live. And even though it's not about me personally, again, this is my community, right? Okay. Like even though I'm very much born here, you know, and my parents settled here, it still hurts, right? Yeah. Because then I think about, what about the children that are watching this? Like, what about this person's children and how they treat other people and all those thoughts always go through my head. So that wellness side of things, of not allowing myself to go down this rabbit hole of of almost like self-deprecation, I think, based on someone else's issues, is difficult. But I think it's being in that mind of someone that is a person of color and also someone that's queer, like it's like I can't explain it sometimes fully to someone like even my husband, who is a white cisgendered man. Like, it's hard to explain to him sometimes the person of color sort of perspective, because it's just not anything that he's ever experienced, right?
And I think that's really interesting, because that's of course something that if you haven't had the first-hand experiences, it can sometimes be harder to relate to, or you haven't felt the exact same emotions. So I think maybe it's not because we are intellectual and not can relate to it, but just because we haven't the opportunity to have the feel it, those emotions ourselves, or being in the exact same. But still, I think also it's so important that becoming aware of that. In some situations, I think we all have some privileges that we aren't directly affected of it. And maybe the role of having, of being a person that has some privileges in the one way or the other, sometimes it becomes even more important to feel a part of the community or be stepping in and tell that. At certain viewpoints or certain behaviors aren't okay. So sometimes I think for myself, if you should give some advice for maybe teachers like me that are not directly a part of the LGBT community, but wants to help the course and see the value or are a bit depressed about the status quo and that some people don't have the same opportunities. What would be your advice for teachers that want to make a difference but are not directly a part of the community?
Well, I think the first big one is not to assume.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even if people think that they are educating themselves, right, like I'm putting out 100 Days of Queer so that, you know, there's the terminology side of things, but it's not as cut and dry as that, right? Like you'll see in a lot of the terminologies, they are so open to interpretation and different nuances, because how do you capture a human experience in a term? So education is big, and it's so important to have it, and also to look for resources that are curated by the queer community. Hear stories, read books that kind of get you as close as you can to the queer human experience. So I think that's a really big one, is the education, but also let that lead to just assumptions and treating people as if how you think they want to be treated, but just letting yourself treat someone like a human being,
we basically are.
And then I think the second one really is to not forget to value the importance of everybody's voices. So not having to, you know, just look for people in the community to talk to, because that can lead to tokenism, that can lead to, you know, just singling out someone just because of their sexual orientation or even gender identity. I think that actually does more harm than good. But having an open discussion just to see where generally everybody is in their understanding about certain issues within the LGBTQ community, I think is probably a more genuine way of going about it. Because at the very end of the day, the thing that is missing are voices. And those voices include people who are in the LGBTQ community, but also people that are allies already, or are figuring out who they are as allies as well. But then also people who are curious, and also people who don't understand it, or people who are like just very against what's happening. And I think all those voices need to come to the table, because what, right? Like at the very end of the day, because that's the only way that we can move forward in as people. Mm. And I think that the call for the strategies for teachers to be able to discuss and lead discussions and have meaningful and purposeful and respectful conversations around all these issues. And that's why I think people are looking for quick advice. They're not looking for just advice. They're looking for things that'll, you know, okay, I just need to read this. I just need to watch these videos. I just need to talk to these people, and then I'm done, right? And I think that's when it comes to human beings, that's just not how we work. So it's that, unfortunately, for a lot of people, you gotta wait. You gotta wait for things, the dust to settle. You've got to, make space for people to feel welcome. And that takes, you know, sometimes weeks, years. So it's a very slow process. So it's not, you know, not everyone's going to be completely there, you know, in a matter of weeks. It's really just valuing those things that we value as human beings to respect each other.
And I think that's very important, just to sometimes really remember to see each other as, first of all, humans and with respect. And that's what we all have in common, that we want to get treated with respect. How would you, I have for the last couple of years as a teacher, especially for when it's the Pride Month, use this Apple Watch face with the rainbow flag or the colors. Mainly just because I wanted to send a signal to the young people that I work with and so on, that I'm open, you can come to me. I have had a couple of young people early in my teaching career that really struggled with their gender identity and took very, way too long time before they found that we could have a discussion and open up also how it affected them. So for me, it was just to show that if you want to, I'm always available to listen to you. I just discovered that people reacted very differently to it. Some they thought, but you are not really a part of the community. That's our call it not logo, but it's symbol for us. And others, they were very positive about it. And what would your take be on it?
Yeah, I've also struggled with this, you know, the rainbow flags, the pride stickers, and then now, as you know, like as we saw a lot actually in this year's Pride, like a lot of commercialization of rainbows.
Brands, they try to use it.
You know, but that aside, I think when it comes to the schools, at the very end of the day, like you put on, you know, your pins or your stickers or whatever it is, because you want people to have a safe space. And you also are an ally, and you are putting yourself out there for that conversation, of why do you have a rainbow flag? Why do you, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then also, I think for a lot of people that are questioning, and for a lot of people who aren't, who may be a part of that conversation, maybe not now, but maybe later, or are uncomfortable with themselves, because, you know, we're, you know, especially with the youth that we work with, you know, there's not just that's going on. There's also, you know, coming of age, there's also, you know, hormones, there's also all that other stuff too. So there's all these different factors that are leading them to be, you know, not maybe wanting to have that conversation just yet. But I think by having those symbols, especially from people of authority, teachers, all of that, it just shows that people are noticed, that people exist, and that I value the, you know, everybody. And I also notice the adversities and the struggles that it means to be a person in the LGBTQ community. So it says a lot, but at the same time, I think, yeah, like there are always going to be criticisms from the LGBTQ community or different allies or people on the other end of the spectrum that just don't want LGBTQ people to exist. But I think at the end of the day, everybody has their own motivations and their experiences, right? So if you are getting some flack from people from the LGBTQ community because they're sort of like, oh, you're taking our symbol, I don't think it's not you, right? And it's that whole you know, thing that I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast, where, you know, like we can identify with how people react to us.
For me, it was thought as a wanting to be an ally hadn't thought about it, but when I heard it, I thought also it's also quite understandable that if people had really struggled and it has been a huge part of their life to find their identity and that they say, okay, but you haven't had the same trauma that I have, I haven't had the same experiences, so I could also understand that some people in the community said, but it's fine that you want to support us, but you can't really. So I just thought it was really an interesting reaction that I hadn't thought or seen coming, but I hadn't thought about it.
And I think it's like at the end of the day, it's about how one perceives themselves as an ally, right? And I think that, you know, like I've had like interesting experiences with people, some who very much are involved in the community and are doing great work with students, allowing them to, you know, or setting up different spaces and conditions for them to be able to express not just who they are, but also be able to do really powerful outreach for the LGBTQ community. But then also, I have been on the other side of the spectrum where I've had to deal with teachers who do on the outside look as if they are supporting and are pushing, you know, education around SOGI and all that. But really at the end of the day, like it's nothing but a resume builder, where they just want to say, yeah, I was part of this. I was part of, you know, handing out these stickers. I was part of wearing this pin. I was part of this. But at the very end of the day, it's like, well, do you really know? Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, and so I understand part of that criticism. But at the end of the day, like, I think for whoever the allies are, they are also on their own journey, right? To understanding the community and getting some of the feedback, and also being able to kind of realize, okay, so it's not just, you know, we come out, it's a celebration, everything is peachy, and yes, there's trauma and all that. Like, there are all these nuances and reactions that we get based on a lot of the times that internalized hatred, that people grow up knowing, internalized homophobia, internalized transphobia, all that stuff that we just a lot of the times don't talk about. And it can cause, I think, people to react. Sometimes allies get the flack of it, but a true ally knows, this is a reaction right now, but I still love the community, right? Like, I still support everything that's going on. I'll still do what I can to support students that are going through different, you know, like different issues in their lives. and I'll put my neck on the line again, right? Like, as an ally, you have to put your neck on the line to kind of go, no, this is not okay, and taking things where they should. So yeah, it's one of those issues, right? Yeah. Like there's no, like with anything, there's no cut and dry answer, because I'm only speaking from my experiences as well, based on, you know, my experiences as a queer, like, person of color. I don't know anything about the Indigenous perspective or the Black perspective, or the white perspective. Like there are so many other parts of this conversation that I will never experience firsthand.
I think other side of it is maybe also in the area where I live, here in Denmark, that part of Denmark, there are, I think, around 20% of the people normally voting for a quite right-wing party. Mm-hmm. And I think most of them are doing it because of fear and haven't traveled that much. And they have maybe a lot of reasons. They can't be angry on the robots that are taking their jobs. Globalization, they're moving a lot of jobs. So they sometimes also maybe are in a situation where they, and then the only way they can react is that some other people are coming, also taking some jobs. That's maybe easier than they, and I don't think that they really are racist, but of course there's a small part of those who are voting there that truly are. And also, of course, among when I'm teaching 400-500 students a year, have a large group of students that I have contact with, of course, and then also meet students that have those viewpoints that I personally have really difficult to cope with and understand. And I think that's also sometimes where we really get tested. How do we actually find the energy in ourselves to actually also sit down there and be open for a discussion and just pushing them away, because then I think then it will be, they for certain will become even more racist if no one is trying to say, okay, let's sit down, where does that hate come from or whatever, and I think that's just one place where I have found that I sometimes struggle but still feel that it's important that I test myself and find that that ability to still to grab a cup of coffee with those students.
Mm-hmm.
And but that must be even harder sometimes when you have felt it on your own in your own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when I bring up, you know, things that I'm noticing in the class around any sort of isms, right? I think students and also colleagues expect, you know, that I will obviously stand up for certain things because of who I am, and not just my personality, but I think because I am a person of color, because I am part of the queer community. But I think, and unfortunately, because I'm part of these marginalized groups, my voice is never going to be heard in this current society as fully as someone who is, you know, white, someone who is cisgendered, someone who is heterosexual. Their voices will always be heard a lot more, especially in our kind of society that we have here, right? And especially in our very much colonized society in BC. And so that's why, those are the allies that we need, right? Because their voices will be heard, and they're the ones that are going to create a lot of change. But they need to reach out to people in the community also to get that full human experience. So it's very tricky, right? There's all these different systemic sort of issues that have to be addressed very slowly, very very gradually to get to a place where we will start to value all voices equally. Although, you know, it's one of those things where I don't know if I'm going to see that in my lifetime. It's going to be a dream if it does. But right now that's not the case, right?
No, and I think it's a bit back and forth. Or if I see over the last 20 years, I think there's a lot of positive change happening. Mm-hmm. But I also think we see things, where things are going the wrong direction. So it would be really difficult to what are we going to see in the rest of our lifetime? How will it? Hopefully it will in the overall go in the right direction, but I think we see that it's going a bit back and forth all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Earlier you said also, we have discussed that we sometimes see those in the curriculum also, on the things that we are doing in school. For example, that many teachers maybe asked kids to line up in two queues. The boys mm-hmm. over here, the girls here, or we have discussed about when you're cooking with the kids, that some recipes or some curricula just is, there's a lot of maybe bias or unintended things where we have this, call it, again, those stereotypical viewpoints that they get reinforced instead of... How do you see that when you are working with curriculum as well? And have you noticed other places where you would love to have a different curriculum or a different practice in school?
Yeah, I think it boils down to kind of what lens we see through as practicing teachers, right? Like when we see resources, when we see different activities that are passed down from other teachers, when we create different learning experiences for ourselves and our students, being able to have a lens that we look through that helps us signal, oh, actually, maybe that's not helpful. And it's not necessary. Like, is it necessary that we split up boys and girls? Is it necessary, you know, like, and there may be certain instances where there's a feeling that, yes, we definitely need to do this. You know, like based on gender identity, but at the very end of the day, like, is it essential for learning to be able to split up boys and girls? Right. And especially, you know, being male and being Chinese in a home economic setting, which is predominantly, you know, white middle-aged women, but the Betty Crocker stereotypical, you know, home economics teacher, it was like, who the heck are you when I first got into the profession? But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, think about all the voices that you have missed up to this point. And I think also thinking critically about, you know, who are writing our curriculum materials, who's being represented in our materials, who's being represented in our texts, what choices am I making around, you know, different themes? Like if I'm looking at a theme of social justice, am I including as much as I can? If I'm looking at a theme around, you know, teenage life, like for a lot of, you know, different texts, like am I looking at that perspective of just, you know, like a peachy suburban life, or am I looking at something where, you know, youth have actually had to struggle, and what does that mean? How am I having that conversation? So I think, yeah, like getting back to your question, I think at the very end of the day, it's why we need to focus on ourselves as teachers, as humans, and realizing that if we don't care about these issues as human beings, and we don't have those little red flags or those little gut feelings that something's not right with the way that I'm phrasing this, or something's not right with my choice of text or my choice of recipe or my choice of moving certain kids around, that sort of thing, then yeah, like, if that gut feeling isn't there, then there's nothing really that can be changed, right? But if we're constantly reading, if we're constantly talking to other educators from diverse perspectives, if we're engaging in those those conversations to get to know all the students that are in our classrooms. Like, that's what's going to create change in our practice.
Yeah, and I thought it was so interesting when we talked yesterday, the example you gave with the recipes, and we talked about it. So I was went back and looked into my oldest son. He has just started to have call it home economics, or where they make food also in school.
Yeah.
And I looked back at the recipes and I thought all of them that they have made and are going to make rest of the year, they are either from Denmark or from the US. So they are learning a lot about making muffins, but yeah, that's not a Danish cake, but an American cake and so on. But there was nothing from the whole Asian Pacific region or Africa or someone. And I just thought, that is definitely not intentional from our school, but we just sometimes maybe because curriculums often get written in English or in England and the US and then get translated and copied, and we often get inspired by a lot of things that are happening in the US and so on. But how can we become much more aware of integrating, having a broader view on things?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think definitely, realizing, oh, you know what, we're not including like different perspectives and different cultures and all that is a starting point. But I think also looking at the school community and seeing if we did touch on those different cultural experiences, would people understand? So are there cultures in our school that could speak to those different cultures that we want to bring in? And so we have maybe someone's parent or someone's uncle or someone's relative come in and showcase from their voices kind of what's indicative of their culture. Or do we risk maybe sometimes pushing even more stereotypical recipes, that sort of thing, from cultures that don't even exist in our school? Yeah. And I think there's a slippery slope there, right? Yeah. Of perpetuating even more stereotypes about different cultures. But at the same time, I think depending on the diversity of particular schools, that's where it's if there's a student who, was raised in Denmark, but has heritage somewhere else, maybe that's an opportunity for them to dig into their heritage a little more, but have them come from their perspective. So I think that's, when it comes down to that conversation about trying to have more perspectives and broaden, the different cultures that we're trying to represent, I think there's an authenticity that needs to be there for it to be done well, right? But I think in Canada, we have a tricky situation, right? We have a very, very unfortunate situation where the whole concept of Canada is built on stolen land from our Indigenous communities that are all over Canada. And so when we're talking about what Canadian cuisine is, and we're talking about what the staple foods are in Canada, unfortunately, most of the time, if not all the time, we're talking about colonized recipes. We're talking about British recipes. We're talking about a lot of foods that were actually used to oppress certain people when they were taken from their homes and put into residential schools or tortured, all those traumas are built into the recipes that we call Canadian. So I think that's the trouble. I think that home economics in Canada needs to look at. And I think we're getting better. I think we're now starting to look more at just general life skills and going from there versus focusing on recipes themselves and saying that they're indicative of certain cultures or saying that they're Canadian foods or saying, anything to that regard. But when it comes to even other cultures, home economics in Canada also is, built on a lot of very stereotypical Asian dishes as well, based on the maltreatment of Japanese that came and the internment camps that happened all over Canada. And then we have you know, like the Chinese head tax and the railroad workers, like who were treated so poorly. And so, like, the more that we get to know, you know, the trauma that our country is built on, the more I think in every single subject area, not even like, you know, just the very, very visual sort of home economics, eating, you know, fashion design, all that kind of stuff, like down to like the way that we teach history, the way that we teach English, the way that we teach science, the way that we value certain problems in math, like all of that is so, so important, to have that, to have that realization before we start to say certain knowledge is truth. So I think, like from my perspective, it is this just huge ongoing thing, especially in Canada, because there are people that are still resisting the fact that, that we violently took land from the indigenous population here, and that, you know, it was genocide. And not enough people are talking about the systems that exist because of that maltreatment of human beings, and what that means in our education system, and why a lot of times it feels like a jail.
But I think it could be really interesting to maybe make a subject where we can teach history and eat a lot of food at the same time.
Yes.
I really enjoy it. But I think it's so interesting that there are so many stories related to food and when they came. Often it's closely linked to historic events. I recently learned that the fortune cookie that most associate with Chinese restaurants actually came from Japan or Japanese people living in the U.S. and they were even more suppressed than the Chinese, so they were living as if they were Chinese just to avoid too much racism, and then they I think there's a lot of interesting stories often related to food. And I just thought when I saw the recipes that my son is going to make in school, oh, there's so many flavors, so many spices from around the world that isn't included. But then you just have to cook with them at home.
Exactly.
So that he discovers also the diversity of spices and flavors. But I think both in food and in life, that diversity is something really valuable to most of us when we start opening up and seeing that. And also just from my perspective, having taught design, innovation, and worked with that both in companies and in schools, that I think that my ideas aren't often that good. They only become better when I am together with people that are different than I am and can offer different perspectives. And in general, I think great ideas is not something that happens in one person's head. That's something that happens between people. And I think that's, we just need to also realize that from, if you want to tackle some of the big challenges with climate change or working in corporations, that we as humanity are just much stronger if we celebrate each other's differences and value that because we have different perspectives and different backgrounds and so on, we can bring something different to the table and often create something very productive.
I think it just speaks volumes of the fact that as human beings, a lot of the times we have so many of the same goals, regardless of what our backgrounds are, right? Our kind of just general need to be a part of something, to belong, to have a voice, to love, to be loved, like all those like very human needs,
basic,
and how they're expressed is very different, right? And we label them depending on kind of what spectrum we're on politically, religiously, like all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, if we're boiling all of it down, like we're all just trying to be, like we're all just trying to be people. And, And I think in education, that's difficult for the teacher. And that's why the teacher is so powerful as a profession and as a person, because it's that tricky situation of how do you navigate the complexity of all these people and in the heart of their coming of age and coming of mind sort of time in their life. And again, I think, yeah, like it starts off as, why are you a teacher? Right. Is it a calling or is it a profession? Is it a vocation? What are you bringing to the profession? Are you bringing stuff? Are you bringing content? Are you bringing, you know, skills? Are you bringing all that? But are you also bringing yourself? Like, are you bringing that humanistic side of you as a teacher into what you do?
Yeah, and I think that is touches back on something very important that we talked about earlier, that I think we need both to be a good teacher is also authentic and bring something of themselves in classroom. But also that we are aware to take care of ourselves and our own well-being. I think that there is sometimes a balance, that how much can we offer of ourselves and when do we need to also shield ourselves a little bit or being aware of our own well-being.
Yeah, self-preservation is not selfish as a teacher, right? Like it's a very giving job. It's a very emotional job. It's a very challenging job and a very rewarding job. But I think, like, especially a lot of the people that I started talking to when I was a beginning teacher, you know, they go, oh yeah, you got to be here till 9 p.m. You have to, you know, do this kind of preparation. You have to, you know, volunteer for 5 different activities. You need to do all this. Because that was a perception without the wellness side of things, that in order to be a good teacher, you had to almost sacrifice your sanity. And I don't want to say it's a millennial thing, because I don't think it is, but I think there's so much more of a conversation around mental health now. There's for everyone in all generations, there's so much more conversation around, you know, it's like a sense of being and also just preserving our souls and making sure that we, you know, focus on what matters and self-care and all of that, that there's no other, like, there is no reason why we need to be sacrificing our bodies, essentially, because it is going to catch up on us, right? Especially mental health wise.
Yeah, definitely. I have sometimes a bit tricky question, but what would be your hopes for the future of education? What kind of changes would you like to see before you retire? So if you look quite long in the future, but what would be your hopes for education and learning and in that time span?
I think looking at kind of where education is going right now, and also looking at where we've come from, which is really important. I think the conversation around consumption versus creation is still very much on the table. I think it's been something that we've talked about for a long time, but it's not something that I think is really part of the school fabric just yet.
There's still a long way to go.
Very much so, yeah.
Potential not getting used to it yet.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just about using technology. It's not just about, you know, having kids do more or anything like that, but it's focusing on student voice. It's focusing on the fact that, you know, you're valuing and validating the experiences that students come into the classrooms with. And if it's a tool like an iPad, if it's, you know, output like Apple Clips, if it's, you know, a beautiful animation that someone's created, or a video or music, but then it could also be a beautiful piece of prose. It could also be beautiful poetry. It could also be a very insightful and mind-shifting essay. Like, yeah, it could be a novel. There are these outputs that I think students have nowadays that we never had as teachers, or sorry, as students in our generation, right? I don't want to go as far to say that like TikTok is going to be life-changing, but there are, you know, social media avenues. There are all these different ways that students are making an impact, and people that are this young are making an impact on the way that other people see the world. And I think that's where I want us to go in education, is to see that, is truly live and see that potential in our students, for them to be able to make an impact in the world. Because even though a lot of times we celebrate, you know, certain voices from students that are starting to make waves and all that kind of stuff, but at the very end of the day, like, are we truly believing in them, or is there still a little bit of that, oh, well, you know, that's cute that they're doing that, right? I think it is a big mind shift for us to really see and live that, those words that we always say that we're doing, right? The co-learning, the collaborating, all that kind of stuff. Like, a lot of people use those terms, but are they actually doing it? Are they actually doing it in an authentic way where they're meeting their students as humans, and allowing them to have voices, and also providing and creating the conditions for them to make impactful change in the world? And so I think that's why I'm so invested in the curriculum that I teach, which is the design thinking curriculum, because I really think that that's a powerful framework for students to work off of. And I think it really can create beautiful, lasting change in so many different avenues of the world, and not just in the kind of technology world that or engineering world that we think design thinking lives. It really is human experience focused, empathy driven sort of framework, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's really fun. Talking a bit about design, I just wanted to go back here to your 100 Days of Queer project. I can see that's made in Keynote. Beautiful animations.
Yes.
And drawings. Where can people find that if they want to learn a bit from you? I think that's an amazing resource.
Well, in short, like, all the videos, I'm re-editing and relaunching them in the coming weeks, so that they can be on YouTube and shared with people via really quick links, but also being able to publicly be able to embed them into presentations and that sort of thing. So it's a request that I got from educators around the world that started to follow the project, because it really just lived on social media for a while, and it wasn't downloadable, it wasn't embeddable, it wasn't any of that sort of thing. So I started to just kind of remaster them a little bit, make them into square videos so that they're more consumable when it comes to certain social media channels, that sort of thing. But at the very end of the day, it started off as a passion project, and I'm very mindful about keeping it that way, and not having it become work. For me, it's, you know, when I feel compelled to, and because it, it really was like a part of my advocacy and activism. I want to have it be that kind of passion driven side of me. Right. But for a long time, it just lived on social media, and I didn't think anyone followed it until one day everyone did, or a lot of people did. Like, oh, okay.
And it's mainly on your Twitter right now. And then maybe I can, I'll definitely update the show notes when it's on YouTube as well.
I did just put out the link, to the YouTube playlist on my Instagram. So it's there just for now, and I think I've only uploaded maybe like a handful of videos just to give people a little bit of a teaser. I'm working on remastering all of them, and then I'm gonna figure out a way to kind of relaunch them all kind of day by day again somewhere. It probably will be on something more like Instagram, so that they're all kind of in one place. versus on Twitter, just because I think it just gets lost, right?
Yeah, on Twitter. Yeah. Yeah. But I could definitely recommend everyone to follow it. It's both a very beautiful work, but more importantly, it's really important work as well. So,
thank you.
So yeah, I will put links to the YouTube and your Twitter and Instagram and in the show notes.
Awesome.
Thank you very, very much for your time today. Are there things that are important to you that I haven't given you the opportunity to speak about? Or
No, I think that really it, like the way I work too, it's just it, like the conversation just flows where it does. And I was able to tap into a lot of good feelings while I was chatting with you. So I'm very grateful that you have created this platform for these types of discussions to happen, especially globally, I think is something that I'm very fortunate and very grateful that you've created, versus, you know, just kind of me living in Canada and having conversations with other Canadians. It's nice to see that we as educators are really talking about the same topics and the same issues, like around the world. So I think that's the power of connecting on social media. I think it's also the power of this ADE community. So I'm in awe of everything that everyone does, especially you. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And really, thank you very much for your time this morning. It has been super lovely to have a cup of coffee over the distance and over FaceTime here with you today.
So, awesome, for sure. And I'm going to move on to my third cup.
Soon. Yeah, that's good. A next espresso.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm really thankful for having had the opportunity to have this very honest and reflective conversation with Jo Tung, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Some of the things that I have reflected on after this very honest conversation is also that I think that we can all learn to be even more aware of when we are in a privileged situation and acknowledging that. And for me, privilege really equals responsibility. When we are in a privileged situation, we are also responsible. It's not enough that we have inclusive values, that we have all the right values. It's actually our actual actions in this world that makes a difference. So it's much more on how we act on our values and not what our values actually are that makes the difference. And sometimes it is for some of our students and the people that we work with and meet on our way in our through our life, it's not always easy to stand up for yourself. And when you are in a privileged situation, we often have the resources to stand up for ourselves. But I think it's much more important and powerful when we are able to stand up for others, and we should use that privilege wisely and with responsibility. Embracing diversity, I think, is really, really important. When we are in a privileged situation, that we embrace that situation, that we put our arms around those people, that we are trying to include those people that don't have the same privileges. Sometimes you maybe can feel that the cake will get smaller. It could be about equal pay for males and females. But embracing that, putting their arms around it, trying to give people the same privileges, doesn't make the cake smaller, in my opinion. That could maybe be the logical thought that, okay, then I will maybe lose a bit of my privileges if I share them with others. But I actually think that diversity adds so much, some new flavors to the mix. It enhances the quality of the work we do when we come together with people with different viewpoints and different experiences and so on. So the quality that we can achieve together just become much better when we really embrace diversity. And when we are trying to put our arms around us and protect those who haven't the same privileges than we have, then we can increase the quality of what we are doing. That gives the cake better flavors, better experiences. And I actually also believe that in many cases, the cake will grow in size, and we will not lose anything by embracing others and putting our arms around those who haven't the same privileges than we have, and trying to give them the privileges that we also enjoy in life. Dear listeners, most of you are working in education, and I think you are doing a fantastic job, a really important job. Keep on doing that. Until the next episode.